Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Schmo Zone podcast. We took the week off last week, but we are back in action. This is episode number 76. I'm Dave Schmolensen, a.k.a. The Schmo. My co-host is...
Helen Yee with Helen Yee Sports.
And today's special guest, he's 18-3, he's a professional MMA fighter. He's a big advocate for something I'm a big advocate for, marijuana. Medical marijuana or normal marijuana for recreational use. Big fan. And also, he is a professional poker player. And he's a ring boy. Elias Theodoro, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Many hats, but I can't wear any.
That's true. You have long hair, though.
Yes, big head, long hair. It's been something I've been dealing with. I've only finally fully, you know, fit in my head, or my body, rather. But I digress.
Well, you look good, man, and you're here in Las Vegas. You've been out here for a little bit, and you're going to be staying here for at least another month, month and a half?
Yeah, that's the plan. Like you mentioned, I wouldn't go as far to say professional poker player, semi-professional poker player. I'm competing with a bunch of pros, knocked a couple outs here and there. I play a lot on the GG Poker felt, and I'm also in town for the World Series of Poker. So really excited to, you know, be on a table with a bunch of people that I have no business being there, as I only kind of picked up poker in the last year. But I don't suck, so that's half the battle.
So was it during COVID?
Basically, my thing. I learned was poker. And then GG Poker, as I mentioned, they actually hooked me up with, because I'm from Toronto. So there's another guy that's been on a tear during poker or during COVID. His name's Ear Egyptian, AKA Egyptian. His full name is Patrick. He's been my poker coach. I've been basically teaching him how to be fit, martial arts, and he's been teaching me the ins and outs of the GG Poker felt. And you know, like I said, I don't suck, so it's actually really interesting to see. You know, it's been an interesting process to kind of learn something new and kind of run with it. During COVID, many of us had a lot more time on our hands. You know, I was still in the gym training, but in many ways, I was able to learn something new with all my time on my hands.
It helps stimulate your brain. You do get punched in the head for a living, but those brain cells are still there.
Yes.
That's good to hear. So you're here in Vegas. Have you been training at all the gyms or just mainly Syndicate?
At the moment, being Syndicate and a couple times at the UFC PI. And, you know, I'm down to train anywhere. Part of what I love about mixed martial arts is the ability to, you know, travel, train, and meet everyone, anyone and everyone on the, what's it called, mats.
And I saw you doing some work with Sean Strickland.
Yeah.
How's that been going?
That's fun. It's fun. He's a wild card, I guess I would say. But still a teddy bear. He might want to rip your head off, but he does it with love.
It's a huge match for him. I think he's getting ready for not Chris Weidman. Luke Rockhold.
Yes. So
that's big.
Yeah, no, really excited for him. He's been on such a tear. He connected me, or I was connected with him by my friend AJ, who's going to be fighting in about 2 weeks at the Contender Series. So he's been here for the last couple of months preparing for that and really excited for that. But obviously, like you said, Strickland, he has Luke to get ready for, and now he has another pretty man to help him get ready for the next couple of months.
And a couple of weeks ago, we had welterweight D-Rod, Daniel Rodriguez, mm-hmm. in here too, and I know he trains at Syndicate,
yep.
and he's looking great as well. He just had a huge win against Kevin Lee.
Yeah, and also in that capacity, he's, I think, six or seven fights deep in like his year and a bit being in the UFC, so that's amazing to see such a tear.
Yeah, I it's funny because right before he got the call up to the UFC, it was the first time I was a ring announcer for an event. It was called Smash Global, and he fought.
Cool.
And that was the last time he fought before he got into the UFC promotion.
Nope.
So it's cool to see him kind of rise up.
Yeah.
And it's good.
And was Donald Cerrone back at the gym?
I wasn't there when he was there, but AJ's been training with him a couple times I saw.
Oh, cool.
Aaron Jeffries.
What's so unique about you is I never got the blessing to interview you. I didn't start blowing up as the schmo in MMA until around 2019. But what's crazy about you, man, is you have such a strong MMA career. You're 8-3, I believe, in the UFC, and the three people that you lost to were all great guys. Like, the last person was Derek Brunson. I believe it was Brad Tavares, and it was Thiago Santos, who fights now at light heavyweight, and you've never been finished. They were all decisions. So it's crazy, too, with kind of the scrutiny that goes along with, you know, your name and the situation. But, you know, you left the UFC still a great fighter and still one of the best middleweights in the world, the way I see it.
Thanks so much. It's been interesting, obviously, you know, a transition, especially for such a long time that, you know, my mixed martial arts, career has been attached to something like the UFC. But I don't know, I as cliche as it might sound, is everything kind of happens for a reason, and I'm kind of doing my own thing. Being able to no longer be with a U.S. Company, and as a free agent, I ironically been able to be an agent of change in the cannabis space, where originally I was both, I got my therapeutic use exemption through the British Columbia government via the commission, and the importance doing it through the commission rather than an organization like USADA is just a company. Right, that is a third-party testing that's hired by someone, where the commission is actually run by the state or provincial government. So my approval for what's called the therapeutic use exemption, the first of its kind in professional sports, set precedent not only for myself, but other athletes, both in boxing and MMA, amateur and professional. And I was able to leverage that into an event where I was both fighter and co-promoter, made it 19 and 21 plus, and it was essentially all funded by weed, mushrooms, and gambling. So, my three favorites. Favorite things. I don't know about anyone else's. And now moving forward, was able to actually get another therapeutic use exemption, the first of its kind in the U.S. Via the Colorado State Commission, and I'm looking to validate that both as fighter and promoter, because I no longer fight for the man; I am the man.
I love hearing that.
Damn,
I love hearing that. So many places to dissect that, but that's a great way to open this. First things first is, I know you've been paying attention to, and we've had Jeff Nowitzki on with the UFC. He's obviously involved with USADA, with WADA, with, you know, all the anti-doping and everything. It wasn't until a couple of months ago, though, that marijuana is now legal in certain states. Mm. Obviously, it varies commission by commission. I'm not sure what it is in New York right now, because that's always a difficult one. But, for example, in Las Vegas, where we're at where we are right now, now fighters, if they have marijuana in their systems, they're not going to be docked a win. They're not going to lose money from their fight purse. You can legally have marijuana and be an MMA fighter now in Vegas.
Yeah, but again, there's different clarifications that still need to be had. With the UFC removing their policy, it's still a policy, so that is in there. It's just them not enforcing it. So there's actually a little caveats. If you ever say that you use it for anxiety or pain, that's actually a flag, because those are performance enhancing under the USADA's aspect. So it's kind of backwards, but it's still going in the right direction through the UFC, where you have to say, I only smoke weed because I like to get high. You can't say, it's a medicine, that's why I use it, because that's considered still a forbidden component under the UFC. In addition, what's it called? My clarification is, being a therapeutic use exemption, it is actually looked at as equal as a medicine. So UFC has always kind of been on the forefront of this. Obviously, you know, now this latest direction, even with those caveats, it's still going in the right direction, and they've been forefronting it. And Jeff Nowitzki is no different. He's been really upfront in regards to that, and is looking at cannabis as not a performance enhancing drug, as, you know, what it used to be essentially classified as, is like something like a steroid or something like that. But the really important thing, or as I kind of see myself in, is the component of, as these different organizations, as these different companies are removing cannabis from the prohibited list, it's also important to credit it for not only as a substance, but also as a medicine. And that's what kind of my clarification is, and what I've been doing. I've applied for therapeutic use exemptions in many different jurisdictions, both in Canada and the U.S., and I'm going to keep on knocking down every single barrier in my way and every dude in my way.
So go back to the origins of this. How did it start, and when did you realize that this was such a better way to medicate yourself rather than like opioids, painkillers, and the other alternative that happens with other professional athletes?
Yeah, so previously, one of my first coaches, Lachlan Chang, he was a medical patient for many years himself, and he was my coach, and we would travel. So anytime we would leave the country or go to a place that didn't have any medical cannabis, I saw the need for him to switch to his, to opioids, painkillers, other types of first line medicines. And I saw what it did to him, not on the fact of the fact that it didn't work as well as cannabis, but also the crippling side effects that came with it. And as my body and my own condition, which is bilateral neuropathy, it's essentially nerve damage of my upper extremities. And as you might imagine, everything I do in my job aggravates that. So when talking to my doctor, I was very cognitive of the component or the fact that cannabis is an option, and first line medicines isn't only the fact that it might not work as good as cannabis, but it also might have debilitating side effects. And as a professional fighter, a professional athlete competing at the highest levels, you want to be, as healthy as you can, both body and mind. And, being forced to take these first line medicines like opioids and painkillers, it was from the jump what I knew I wanted to avoid. So when talking to my family doctor, we started using cannabis, and again, it worked really well for me in the many different ways I administer it, because I don't just smoke it. I vaporize it because I vape like a professional. I also, eat it. When you don't put, we don't apply heat to cannabis, it's originally comes as THCA, which is raw cannabis. So I actually grind that up in my my kale or like a smoothie, and then I get all the anti-inflammatories. I have different types of rubs that I put on the different areas in regards to my body, depending on how much it hurts. Tinctures, high doses CBD, and obviously a lot of weed. But backtracking, when the UFC partnered with USADA, I was very happy and proud of the organization doing that. They wanted to clean up the sport, and I'm a huge believer in clean sport. Been clean my whole life. And so when they actually started to partner, my coach and I, who I mentioned, we actually got to meet Jeff Nemansky a couple of months before the program was enlisted, and we started talking to him, and he seemed like always a honest broker in regards to someone that has always had the fighter's best interests in mind, right? And that came with both in regards to the performance enhancing aspect, but also looking at cannabis, something like cannabis, and not forcing athletes to take endless amounts of prescription pills. It left me very encouraged. It was, but obviously as the process went through, it was an uphill battle, because USADA is actually completely funded essentially from the U.S. government, and the U.S. government still has cannabis as a Schedule One drug, which means it has no medical properties under its classification. So USADA, because the whole process of a therapeutic use exemption, it took about 5 years to eventually get approved. They never necessarily tell you no. They just say you're denied, and this is the reason why. And the list eventually kept on getting smaller, to the point where there was only two or three more things that were on the list. They approved that I had proved my case of bilateral neuropathy, essentially nerve damage of my upper extremities, as I mentioned. But they wanted me to do, again, it's very backwards. They wanted me to take every drug under the sun to eventually come back to cannabis, to the point where, like, we're talking about like SSRIs, antidepressants, different types of stuff. And the irony, which was like, the irony was never lost on me. At the same time, they were going through all these campaigns about creating awareness about opioid addiction in athletes. So they're literally saying, don't do pills and don't do drugs, kids, while they're telling me, Elias, you need to do more drugs and more antidepressants. So again, we're not just talking about like, take two pills and see if it works. No, I had to do, originally we did 21-day cycle because that's what my doctor said would prove the case. And then when I did a bunch of different pills, they said, no, we want 9 weeks. So I basically had to take an opiate, an SSRI, an antidepressant. And again, the list that they came up with was so ridiculous that my doctor would laugh and go, "Well, you don't even prescribe this for pain anymore. Hasn't done that since the 80s and 90s. And that's essentially when USADA was kind of created. There was a preliminary thing before that, but it eventually became something like the late 1990s. But I digress. The point being, it was the irony of the whole process where they're telling me to take all the pills while they're telling everyone else, don't take pills.
What was their reasoning, though?
The reason is a different classification. Like, there's different points that you have to basically hit. Different like wording under their like list. There was like a list of 10 reasons. They have like, you know, 3, 4, 5 doctors or whatever like that that are like a committee of sorts, and they kind of either say yes or no kind of thing. And it was just it was really them just kind of dragging their feet. To the point where, again, I added different doctors, not only my family doctor, then I would add a sports medicine doctor, then a pain doctor, then I had I forget her technical term, but she is basically a researcher that compiled all of my pain scoring, because I was taking journals, I was writing every single day, I was basically doing the process. But it all basically comes down to the USADA gets paid by the United States government to basically look at cannabis that way, because it's still a Schedule I drug.
And let's go back to why it's a self-scheduled one drug. It's like, you look at the industry, you look at, as someone who's a big fan of marijuana myself, like, it's such a better alternative than tobacco, than to alcohol, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But if you look at how it became this way decades ago in the first place, the propaganda behind mm-hmm. it for these corporations mm-hmm. to make money and to take it away, it's so funny how now we're coming full circle, and now it's like, with the legalization of marijuana, governments are finding ways to profit off of it, so now they can legalize it.
Yep, with 2 million people still in jail for it, essentially. Yeah. Or no, 45,000 people are still in jail for non-violent weed offenses. In addition, I think there's like something like 2 million people that have some type of permanent record, and because it is a federal crime, right? So, and there's also some states, there used to be more, but it was actually a way to, beyond your jail sentence, to take away your right to vote, take away your voice. And like you said, it all comes back to, you know, different types of lobbyists, different types of money interests, and different types of racists. That's what it all comes down to. In the early 1900s with William Randall Hearst, who owned all the paper mills, he owned all the, you know, the newspapers as well, put in the fact that, throwing some racism in the aspect of marijuana, spooky name, is giving black and brown people superhuman strength, and they're attacking people. We need to stop this substance. And they put heavier and heavier criminal components to it. You fast track to the 1960s with the war on drug, and that was a way for Nixon to put people in jail, not for freedom of speech protesting the Vietnam War, but, you know, if you were to stop them and they happen to have a little weed on them, then you can really mess up their life for a bit. So again, and then throw in the for-profit prison system, where the only exception to in the U.S. still now for slavery is the 13th Amendment prison. So the whole for-profit prison system is another aspect where you can throw someone in jail, make them essentially a slave for, you know, if you don't pay them pennies on end. And now with the technology that they have, just to have human contact with your family, the amount of money and debt that goes into that component, it essentially is like $100,000 to $200,000 per person in jail. And, you know, I don't know, I come from a country that doesn't really like to throw people in jail for plants.
I was going to say, that's pretty well versed for someone who wasn't born in this country and raised in this country. Like, how do you see the laws in Canada and how they've coincided with the laws in America and the progression of where we are today?
Well, we have our own original sin as well, in our way of treating First Nations, the Native population, our residential school and different components in the medical aspect. I think in Canada there were very negative components in regards to what medical officials could do to the rights of any type of indigenous person in Canada up until like the 80s or something like that. So again, we're not perfect, and there's many different components of racism and injustices that have happened. I think there's different components. Obviously, we're a much smaller country, so there's more ability to unify in regards to different processes or different turning the page and moving forward in regards to enlightened way. I think in the States it's all about money, but at the same time, America is the land of the free for many different other things. It's the best experience. It's the original experiment, if you will, in regards to our modern day, democracy, republic, whatever we come from, in regards to, more open societies. So, yeah, I'm not poo-pooing on the U.S. in any way, shape, or form. I got a lot of family here. I love it here. I'm looking forward to be here for the next couple months, if not longer.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, with that segue, and we'll probably get back more into it, let's talk about some fights, too. Did you catch what happened this weekend with Evander Holyfield and Vitor Belfort and Tito Ortiz, Anderson Silva? What did you make of the whole Triller stuff?
Well, Silva, man's timeless. As great as he was as a mixed martial arts legend, champion, UFC champion, holy crap, at the age of like 40-something, he's still killing it in boxing. Obviously, Tito is one thing. Tito's a great fighter, but he's obviously a little past his prime in his own right. But the fact that what he did with Junior in his last fight, that was wholly impressive.
A real boxer.
Yeah, his first outing was, against a legend, a legend's son, but what's called a pretty badass boxer himself.
What do you make of kind of these crossovers, like MMA versus boxers or MMA fighters versus boxers? Like, are you a fan of this? And
for
even
sure.
Like the Jake Paul?
Love it.
Tyron
love to
Wood.
See it. I love people breaking the matrix in any way, shape, or form. That's what he's kind of doing. He's doing his own thing. The man's a former Disney star. He's kicking ass. He's picking the right fights in regards to where he needs to be. Even the next one where he might actually fight a boxer, which is Fury's brother. Did you see his last fight? It wasn't that great. Wasn't that great. Holy crap. Like, even that's a great fight for him. So, he's doing his thing. I don't hate on it in any way, shape, or form. The only thing I would kind of throw out there is the aspect of some of these legends components. Like, someone like Holyfield, he looked like he had no business being in there, right? Like, on all the... I say that with nothing but respect. The guy is, a champion. You just don't want to see someone do that. Don't want to see someone get hurt, especially that later in their career, where any type of knockdown, any type of hit probably has even worse ramifications at his age.
We were in LA last week because we were supposed to go to the fight, but then when they moved everything to Florida, when obviously Oscar De La Hoya got COVID and they switched it, and then they announced Holyfield, I didn't want to go, and it was my first instinct. I interviewed Holyfield a couple of years ago at the Super Bowl at the Radio Row, and he's turning 59 next month. And look, he physically looks great, but like, just from the way his speech is, the way he walks, I knew there's no way this guy would ever get back in the ring again. And here we are a couple years later, he got back in, short notice and everything. Yeah. And I'm just surprised that more people didn't realize this than there were before. There's probably just as many people picking him to win the fight as Vitor.
Yeah, no, I think, again, obviously a memory is one thing, because people think, some of these guys are timeless and stuff like that. And two, the capacity of, I saw him hit pads leading up to it, and I was like, shit, that's like, it's my grandfather. That's like my, that's my dad, actually. Like I don't even like my dad. Like, I wouldn't want him to get hit in the head in any way, shape, or form. Obviously, my dad's not, a former champion, but the point being, is one, everyone has a price, and hopefully he got his. But obviously, I think someone like Titor, that is Vitor, sorry, we were talking about Tito earlier. I confused them both. But point being with Vitor, he's still very much a game fighter who's been kind of getting ready for the last X amount of months or years since his departure from the UFC. I don't think he's left the gym. Like, I was training with him in TriStar when he was out there during the latter part of his UFC run. So, I knew his head was still in the game. So, I'm happy for Vitor in regards to what potentially that sets up him. I don't think he'll end up fighting Jake. I know that's who he's calling out for, but I don't think that's who they'll end up putting him against.
Anderson Silva, though?
That makes total sense, but I don't think Anderson wants to. He said, I don't know if you saw one of those interviews of him where he said he literally has to put the kiss or the foot to the face
or
on his chest.
Anderson versus Jake.
That'd be pretty cool.
But that's the thing, too. It's like, everyone's talking about, this is what they want. I don't think the MMA community has really caught on to the fact that he wants them talking about him.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's like, look, he's not going to take the fight unless it's going to generate the revenue for it.
Yeah.
Like, for Anderson Silva, that's a dangerous fight, but is, and obviously he's a legend, but is the trash talk, which is an important component to lead up and sell, is that going to be there? Probably not. There is a storyline with Tommy Fury, but like you mentioned, he did fight like shit in that, in his last fight. He did not look good.
Against a 0-1 MMA boxer.
Fighter. Yeah.
Who was literally a 155er that just didn't cut weight to weigh in as him. And the guy looked like a shit brick house.
Yeah.
Like, he literally looked like he was made out of granite. And it sucked.
It sucked. So for him, it's like, you know, those two make sense, right? And especially goes along the theme of past their prime MMA fighters, but has hands in developing. The other, there's interesting components. So you could take a Jorge Masvidal, obviously.
True.
He's a little bit bigger than him, but doesn't matter. But Masvidal's got the hands. But it's interesting to see where we're at and how boxing has kind of just welcomed this. It's kind of opened its eyes to this, and this is where we are in the state of the sport. This is how it happens, and this is what's getting the younger audience involved.
True. Now, it comes down to the fact that it's sport entertainment. You know, it's about how many people will watch it, and both brothers have a huge audience that will watch anything and buy anything that they hawk. So, yeah.
And not only that, but in boxing, for years and years, it's like, it's so hard to get the best boxers to fight the best. It's like pulling teeth.
Yep.
So, and they feed right into this too, because this is just selection. This is selecting who's going to fight who. We bring this up all the time. Like, best fighters fight the best fighters. Get welterweight. Who fights who? Errol Spence Jr., Terrence Bud Crawford. That's the match to make. You know, like, why the hell are we still waiting for Caleb Plant to unify against Canelo? Finally, I think we're going to see this in November. Has it been official? But, like, that's what has to happen. And that's the thing, though, that made me draw to the UFC, too. Like, because you get all the types of arts combining here, and everyone fights everyone. The best fighters always fight the best fighters, and that's just how you got to duke it out.
For sure. No, totally agree. Yeah, again, it's breaking that matrix, and both the Paul brothers have been able to do it. Obviously, Jake a little bit better in regards to skill wise, but you know, it's fun. It's entertaining to watch.
Let's talk about you, though, being a, you know, I love your job too. One of your jobs, you have many jobs, but for Invicta, the all female promotion, how did you become the ring boy?
I did it with a local promotion out in Montreal when I was training out in TriStar. Did it out there, and you know, had a blast with it, filmed it, the whole thing, and then sent it to Shannon, and it was like, hey, what do you think? And I basically said that, again, I'm not looking to subtract, only add to a great night of you know, fights, and with all respect. And she gave me an opportunity to do it, and kind of been running with it since. And beyond Victa, I've done it for about like five or six other different types of organizations that during their female fights.
So being an 18-3 middleweight fighter, and Khabib recently talking about what ring girls are, I think Ariana Celeste and Brittany Palmer from the UFC, what's your take on the usefulness for ring boys or ring girls?
Well, I think, again, it's sport entertainment, as we all talked about. It's, you know, part of the whole, you know, pageantry, part of the whole component of, you know, a fight, you know, all the way back to like the 1800s in boxing. It's always been, you know, a part of it for in some capacity. And, you know, originally my process was, you know, the component of it in regards to the certain aspect of, you know, social justice, where they were trying to like remove ring card holders because it sexualized women, where I thought kind of, you know, adding to it was, you don't want to, you know, take away someone's job. You want to, you know, add if you're going to look at that. So, you know, when it comes to Khabib, obviously he can have his own, it's his own promotion, it's his own organization. And obviously he comes in it from a bias aspect in regards to his own personal and religious beliefs, and, you know, all the power to him in that capacity. But I disagree with it in the capacity of, you know, both the aspect of if a person wants to, you know, apply for a job, which happens to be a ring girl or a ring guy, then it should be something that, again, has always been attached to, you know, boxing in some capacity and mixed martial arts, therefore. And I'm all for keeping people's jobs.
Are you the only ring boy, or are there more and more now?
Well, I think there are more now. I've definitely seen a couple, like, I've been tagged in a few where, like, part of, again, I think that, again, all the power to everyone that's done it. I think some of them have been on a more gag aspect, and some of them have been more on a, you know, contemporary component. So, you know, all the power to it. The answer is not less, it's always more.
And looking at the middleweight division and someone that you fought that David mentioned earlier, Derek Brunson, did you catch his last fight against Sarin Till?
No, it kind of went the way I expected. It's amazing to see him, at his age, have that almost breakthrough momentum in the capacity of he's always had, he's always had the wrestling pedigree. He's always had the, try and knock your head off explosive component to it. But now he actually seems to have his own head in the actual fight. And I was there, right, kind of on that cusp of that, momentum in the capacity of his coaches did a really good job because we kind of expected him to kind of rush me. And again, that's why I think my last fight with him wasn't the most spectacular one, because he didn't come at me like a charging bull. And I kind of planned to be, a little bit of the matador, or like the matador to his Russian bull. But again, all the power to him. He's been able to rack up quite the, quite the run. And I couldn't be happier for him. Obviously, the finish is kind of what I expected in the capacity of Darren Till's already been kind of, finished with submissions. If you kind of get him on his back, I kind of heard, I think, Bisman talk about this in one of his shows or whatever. He was talking about how Till, if he does straight jiu-jitsu, he's probably pretty good at, blocking or, kind of getting away out of things, maybe even a couple of takedowns himself. But if you put it all together, he kind of gets lost. And I think he kind of gets lost in the sauce on the ground as well. And that's kind of where Derek is very dangerous, especially with the ground and pound and his heavy shots that he can kind of add to it, and just his overall wrestling pedigree.
He's been derailing all the hype trains.
Yep.
In his last fights too, it's just been very impressive that he's been able to impose his will on the Kevin Hollands, the Edmund Shahbazians, and Darren Tills. And I think at this point too, he's one away if he's not right there, and it's Jared Cannonier and him. Those are the two top guys to contend after Whitaker fights Izzy in that rematch.
No, 100% agree. And again, there's that aspect of a potential rematch, that talking about a narrative, talking about, again, a storyline. There it is right there. You obviously have someone that got starched by the champion, but who's put together a huge pedigree of people that he's beaten on this road to get back there. And again, it really just looks like if Brunson shows up with, the right mindset, he's pretty much unstoppable.
What do you think Izzy has to do to surpass Anderson Silva as the greatest middleweight of all time?
Keep winning.
How many more wins would you say?
I don't know exactly. No,
because
I think
he's at the point now where he's lapping.
And
Usman is too. You can argue too in the welterweight division.
They're
fighting all the guys that are going around the second time.
No, it's very true. Again, and obviously his contemporary would be someone like George St. Pierre. Records were meant to always eventually become broken in many ways, and it just really depends. It's like a public opinion, right? Like, there's no actual. It just really depends if people like them, right? I think that's where it comes down to. I think Izzy has that that je ne sais quoi about him in regards to his style and kind of his silliness and in his anime and just him being him and unapologetically so, right? Whereas like Usman, I think it was a little bit. He's a little bit more reserved and a little bit more in his shell, but he's still undeniable in regards to his, ability.
Yeah, for sure.
And looking at both of their upcoming rematches, how do you see it playing out? First off, Izzy and Robert Whittaker.
Yeah, well, I think it really comes down to Whittaker kind of staying in. Because he tried to mimic the way I've seen or heard him kind of describe it afterwards. He kind of tried to mimic Gaslam in regards to how he approached in the pocket or something like that, and he got caught for it. Izzy was able to pull that hook and just put him out, right? So it really just depends, I think, on Whittaker kind of reinventing what his approach is, because obviously the first time it didn't work. And is he having that momentum, having, again, the attributes of, a little bit taller, a little bit longer, already having the win on him, being a champion for as long as he has, that those things kind of add up in regards to whether it's not a physical thing, it's like a tangible thing, like not as physical as, let's say, his attributes of what he has on someone like Whittaker, but also that feeling of belief inside.
Yeah, what I just noticed too about Izzy, especially in that fight, we were there in Australia, and when I watch his fights, the biggest difference I notice with him is his speed, his ability to counterpunch, and his ability to move. it's different than what I've seen in the middleweight division. And then what you saw with Jan Błachowicz when he went up to fight him at light heavyweight, just the sheer size and the wrestling ability. You get someone who can slow down the fight, get on top of him, and control where it's going to go. That's the difference maker. And we haven't seen that yet at 185, but, you know, it could change.
Yeah, no, exactly it. And again, I think especially when you're at that high of an echelon, it really just comes to like not even inches, it's millimeters, right? And again, he tried to obviously, go to light heavyweight, and no one's been able to recreate that at middleweight, like you mentioned. But obviously now there's a blueprint of how to kind of beat him. And Whitaker's a very capable person in all of mixed martial arts. So again, who knows what his actual game plan is, but obviously there's a blueprint to beat him because the last guy did.
But what about for Usman and his rematch against Colby?
That's an interesting one. Obviously, it was the last fight was just an amazing fight. And obviously, it's one of those interesting things where like someone's body gave, like he broke his jaw, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Right. And then from there, kind of like the TKO eventually came. So that's like a little difference. It really, I think, happened. It really it comes down to what Kobe's mentality is. I think Usman just has to do Usman. He just knocked out Masvidal. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so that component of that tangible, like, you know, like you said, getting in your stride as champion, now lapping people because you now have to do someone over again. So that component, I think, builds in your overall confidence, at least, if not the definitive component, but like at least the person that's going in there to try and be the best that they can be and as good as they are, and you know, every single session that they've kind of built up leading up to this moment, and you know, all the, you know, experience that they've had to that, you know, game day. Because like nothing's more important, like our sport, it's very like game day is the most important thing, but it's hyper important in regards to mixed martial arts or, you know, combat sports, because they're, you know, you're not playing a team the best of seven. It's that day, right? You know, 9 times out of 10 you might be able to beat someone, and so far 1 out of potentially 10 Usman has his number.
As someone who's trained at TriStar and who's been there a lot, obviously there's a lot of well-known people. Coach Firas Sahabi, GSP, was obviously linked to the boxing match with Anderson Silva. That didn't happen. He's still under contract, even though he retired. But hypothetically, if we were to see GSP box Anderson Silva, how do you think that would have played out?
Was that the thing? I thought that the Khabib versus...
We can get to that too. That was the thing.
That was
first.
The really thing, and then it was. What's his name? Not. It wasn't Anderson. It was Oscar? De La Hoya. Yeah.
It was De La Hoya. Sorry, it was.
Yeah,
De La Hoya.
It was De La Hoya for charity. That's what
for
it was.
For charity. Okay.
Hey, I think George has never looked better. The guy's 40 and he's a total babe. Like, he's like got abs on abs, and he's just doing his water wings stuff and at home and doing planks. And
he's got good hair too.
Great hair. Yeah. Great hair, George. No, I think, again, where you compare that to someone like De La Hoya, who probably isn't in the best shape of his life, to the point where, again, he got COVID. Hopefully he's feeling a lot better. But he's at that even older age than someone like George, who is under that potential risk component of COVID because of the fact of, you know, any type of, partying and all the tolls that it may have taken on to his body. Don't get me wrong, George likes to party much different ways. But what's it called? But even when he was champion and stuff like that, he'd always be back in the gym the very next day in regards to no matter how late of a night was or whatever like that. I just think, again, I think George is the specimen athlete, and I think he would come at it correct.
I think I was just thinking wrongly because we were there at the Olympia thing where they had that face off.
Yeah, that fight never happened. Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, is George going to go up to 185? Is Anderson going to go down to 170? And that was the problem, though, with the Khabib fight. Khabib at 155, him at 170. They weren't going to do a catch weight at 165, which I think they should have done. Mm-hmm. But, like, I just don't think George, with this situation, is ever coming back to MMA. He doesn't need to. Do you think he's going to come back?
Everyone has a price. Everyone has a price. And I think just with the UFC, it's the component of, again, beating their champion and then not competing again afterwards. I think that was their big, they feel a little burned in regards to the Bisping component, in regards to the middleweight division, where he said, yeah, we're going to defend this. And it's like, oh, retiring again. But again, he's a champ champ. He's one of the best to ever do it. And again, if anyone can go and what's it called, do water wings for another 4 years and come back and beat a 155 or a 170 or a 185 champion, it's George.
So speaking of everyone has a price, then do you think that Khabib would ever come back?
I think that's the fight that would probably interest him in regards to, especially with his, the whole component is with his mother and his father, or his mother and him in regards to like her not wanting him to go back. Then there's also the component of his father, you know, wanting that to kind of be one of his last fights to be 30-0 or whatever it ends up being. I think that would be the component. But I think he now signed with a football team. He's going to be playing soccer.
Oh, that was fake. That was fake news. Was I heard. I saw Ali, his manager, point out that's fake news or something.
I was kind of hoping that'd be so. That'd be so cool.
He'd probably do well though.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of his like a first passion, if I remember correctly, what I read for. Like he was kind of like getting groomed for that component.
But everyone just assumes like, oh, he'll make it. He'll be a professional Major League Baseball player. I grew up in the 90s in Chicago, the greatest basketball player of all time, Michael Jordan. Like, he left to play baseball, but he didn't make the White Sox. He played for AA Birmingham for a year and a half before he came back to.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough to be a two-sport. The only two. Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders.
Yep.
That's come to mind. Those are crazy athletes.
Yeah.
Arnold Allen, he trains at TriStar.
Yep.
We've talked about him before because Tom Aspinall, who's the heavyweight prospect, he was in here a couple weeks ago, and we're just talking about how underrated he is in the featherweight division. I think he's on, what, an 8-fight win streak in that division, something crazy like that. And obviously he's known for his grappling, but where do you think he is, and what do you think it's going to take for him to get the rightful shine?
I think, well, I totally completely agree. He's a beast. He's underrated. I've seen him, you know, smash legends and also come back from behind in regards to really close fights and just tap someone out when we were both fought in Liverpool. And it was actually such an amazing thing to see him and his dad. It was just hilarious. I don't know if you guys remember the interview and all that jazz. He's honestly so funny and such a sweetheart, but also a killer. So, I think it comes down to, one, him winning more, obviously. Everyone loves a winner. And it takes the right moments. He's had already some of them that I think, again, just kind of encapsulate who Arnold is, and you know, both as a fighter and as a person. But it just takes more fights. I think with him, the unfortunate thing is, as it happens with the mixed martial arts, as one's, you know, mixed martial arts career can kind of progress, it's injuries. I think he just unfortunately had a couple fights that didn't line up because of injuries, and he had to pull out. And it's even as impressive as his like 7-8 fight win streak is, he could have had more if he was completely healthy all the way through. But I am pretty sure he's completely healthy and looking to fight soon.
In that UFC 145 weight division, it's so interesting to see the guys that are climbing and soaring right now, and the differences in styles, like Giga Chikadze and his kickboxing style, and the contrast that would be with Arnold Allen. Like, I could see that collision course, and the winner of that being the one who can impose their style and their will further in that fight. Like, that to me intrigues me. I like when these divisions, there's pathways to seeing what the next wave is, the future is. That always excites me.
Yeah, and again, he's very young with Arnold. He's just young, and he's got nothing but you know, the future and the you know, what comes next ahead of him.
And we just spoke to Brian Ortega.
Nice.
We saw him, so I'm excited for that fight. That's the 25th.
Yep.
You were a TriStar when Kevin Lee came over.
We kind of missed each other in regards to our travel, because I originally, like, I'm from Toronto,
right?
But Montreal's not too far from there, so I would have a place down there, and I would always go down there for a couple months or whatever like that, come back home, and we kind of just missed paths or whatever like that. But just about when he first started coming over, I kind of was still there.
Because it's just so interesting to me, because he's someone who's still pretty relatively young and so much potential, but obviously things haven't gone his way. Mm-hmm. You know, some people can't put the dots to it, but I know he spent time over there in TriStar, and obviously with the pandemic, and he's got a home here in Vegas, he goes back and forth, but I don't think he's gone really up to TriStar since the pandemic started.
No, it makes sense. What's called, Quebec was hit kind of hard in regards to both not only the pandemic, but also the reaction to it in regards to the officials and stuff like that. So I think that was just a weird aspect, not only for Kevin, but I think for a lot of the U.S. athletes that were there or whatnot. So strange times.
Yeah.
Has it been better recently?
Yeah, it's better, but what's it called? I think with Canada, it's a very interesting component. Like, again, those same components where I think without jumping too much into it, I think with a lot of it was the early aspects of where a lot of the Canada, more specifically, I can't speak to the U.S. necessarily, but Canada specific, majority of our deaths happen to old folks' homes and long care homes. Those are the only private care in Canada. So when prior to this, all of the old folks' homes, essentially anyone that worked there made minimum wage. So when the pandemic happened, they had no PPE. They said, to hell with this. We're just going to go work at a coffee shop and make the same amount of money and not have to wipe anyone's ass and worry about a plague. So we're going to do that. So then they just, all the old people just kind of died. Our military wrote a couple of reports about it where essentially they don't know how people died of COVID, bed sores, not getting their medicine, not getting food. It's anecdotal, but I know like 2-3 people that have parents there or like grandparents there. And because again, it's similar to New York where you weren't allowed in. So like you can't go in and stuff like that. Where like a resident will have fallen and just because they broke their hip, they couldn't move and no one heard them for 3 days and they're just pissing and shitting themselves. So like 95% of all death in Canada happened in these old folks homes the first 3 months. And because of that, they use that statistic to keep to make COVID seem like it's as deadly as the measles, but it's not anywhere close to the measles. So again, it is a bad disease. It's a real thing, but it affects people. Your own CDC has talked about it. Anything between 4 to 6 core morbidities. Again, we're only talking about sickness, but we never talk about health. That's my issue.
Yeah, it's reactive and not proactive.
Exactly. It's like, okay, I'm a believer in science. I actually came here partly. I waited to get my vaccination. I'm going to get my vaccination here by J&J because it's the first one, or it's I'm getting J&J because it's made of the kind of vaccine that we've always used for coronavirus. It's no MNRA or whatever the acronym is. Again, believe in science. I'm sure a lot of really important people did all the important stuff behind it. It's just I want to get the J&J one because I already had it. I already had COVID. And I literally, because I worked on a TV and film set during the pandemic when I was kind of building up my own event and whatnot. So I worked on a couple of TV shows and we got tested 3 times a week. And that's what it should really come down to. Every job either should offer it or a government should pay for it. And in addition to, in regards to Canada, what our issue was is the U.S. actually essentially socialized everything that has to do with COVID. So like your vaccines, they were paid for by the government essentially. All your testing, all your care, like you have essentially healthcare for one specific thing because again, it's proactive. Where in Canada, we went the wrong approach and we went private. So we bought all of the contracts for other countries with vaccines. So we had to take so long to get our vaccines. And even then, we don't have, like all of ours are MNRA vaccines, where it's like, that doesn't really give you a choice. You just pick 3 and like, so they had to pick like 4 or something like that originally. And like even AstraZeneca, no one really even accepts AstraZeneca. So it's like, now there's a bunch of Canadians with AstraZeneca where like America doesn't even approve it. Other places in the world don't even approve it. So I mean, it's kind of disheartening in regards to my, like, I'm very proud Canadian. It's a little disheartening in regards to, I don't know, what our current leader has been kind of doing in regards to even just, I don't know, the riling up in the division in regards to vaccinated versus unvaccinated. We're all Canadians. We're all humans. I don't know. And I'm a classic liberal. I believe in pro-choice, no matter what your body choices are. So I don't know. It's just one of those things where I like to keep it consistent. And I just think a lot of people, for political reasons, aren't keeping it consistent.
Yeah, transparency is key. We've gone into that so much. I did want to get to, before we ended the podcast, I want to get into your self-promotion and also just your thoughts too on, you know, I'm sure you've sparred, stoned, you've got into it. Just your thoughts on fighters that are high when they fight. Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think cannabis, and like my clarification, I would say is I'm not trying to be inebriated in the actual fight. So my argument and what I've been kind of fighting for is that one, the standard of testing is actually wrong. So you test a female 115er. The same way you do a 260-pound man.
Yeah, nice.
I know people that, for instance, they're heavyweights. They're just big dudes. They're big, fat dudes. And they got busted for weed, and they did their own private analysis, and it was 81 days to get out of their system, which doesn't make any sense. And so that's standard of component. Also, in addition of and kind of thrown it into, like, with female bodies, their bodies are different because, again, there's the water soluble, and the way that the testing happens, it kind of persecutes their cycle against them, right? Because they kind of retain water and retain fat in a different way than men do. But yet we have the same standard of testing, which is, again, faulty. In addition, my argument was to basically look at cannabis no different than alcohol. So they wouldn't let a drunk person fight, so they shouldn't let a high person fight. But I'm not asking to smoke weed right before I fight. I'm asking to medicate as prescribed by my doctor and afforded to me as my fundamental right as a Canadian and a part of the Charter of Rights and Freedom in my country to do so. So my aspect is actually medicating all the way essentially up until game day. That's what I've kind of argued. And, you know, training, what ends up happening is I usually kind of wait to you know, light up, if you will, after the fact in regards to training, because I'm kind of doing a receptive and the pain management component of me as an athlete. So it's me, you know, after the wear and tear, after, you know, any of the bumps and bruises and, you know, the flares that come with, you know, just my kind of dangerous job. I medicate after as a, you know, again, both reactive and proactive, kind of leading up to it. There's some maybe some wiggle room in between in regards to training, but for the most part, it's kind of before, like a little bit before and after. But again, I probably smoke so much weed that it's kind of all consistently. Because it's funny because kind of going on that, running with that, I think the previously with the UFC, it was like 150 nanograms is when you would kind of flag over. It was like 125 or 150. I have like 1500 nanograms at any given waking moment. But the half-life eventually, you know, half-life's every 3 days, give or take. It would take about 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get fully out of my system. But like at any given moment, probably like 1000x, whatever you're allowed to do.
Never been tested for that, but I'm sure I'm probably
right up there,
right up there too. But the other aspect too is I love that you're your own self-promoter as well, and that's what you're doing. Your last fight was my birthday, March 13th of this year. Great day, by the way.
I'll remember forever. I will be giving you happy birthday messages from now on.
I appreciate that. So, yeah, you've been 2-0 since leaving the UFC. No. I mean, not you're still such a great fighter, but talk to us about the promotion side. So you're involved with fights that you're also co-promoting too. That's kind of exactly, we just brought up the Paul brothers and stuff. That's what they're technically doing in the boxing world. They're co-promoting this. They're partners with Showtime. I guess that's the recent organization they're working with, but talk us through your side of things.
Yeah, no, it's been a fun, eye-opening experience. I got to partner with Rise, which is a promotion out in British Columbia. I'm in the process of talking to different promotions out in Denver or more broadly Colorado is kind of the game plan. But I've been able to, again, both be you know, the fighter, the promoter, and also in many ways, you know, the person that's kind of procuring all of these different partners. And I've been able to, you know, one, hold a decent enough conversation to get people to believe in, you know, my dream and kind of what I'm doing and running with. And I couldn't be more excited because, again, if I was to have done this, let's say, with another organization, I would have been a contract worker and they would have owned the rights to whatever I do. So after this next fight, I kind of, both Canada and the U.S., and, you know, maybe we'll do somewhere else in the world as well, too. But the game plan is to kind of go to another organization after the fact, after this one event. But most importantly, like I said, anything I do with cannabis, I'm not going to be fighting for the man. I am the man, and I own every single piece of right to all the content. So couldn't be more excited to kind of, you know, kind of go my own way and do it in, you know, the unbeaten path, if you will. And everything I do with cannabis will kind of be that way.
So is your next fight going to be in the state of Colorado, you would say?
Yeah, that's the game plan.
In the next upcoming months, any kind of date?
November, December is kind of what I'm aiming for.
185, and do you have an opponent?
For sure. That's going to be a process that, again, once I lock down a potential co-promoter, there's certain legalities. Like, I don't want to be picking my own opponents.
True.
But basically, again, I'm going to be looking for the best fighter that's a free agent and available. And I've already beaten two former UFC fighters, and wouldn't mind beating a third one as well. Or another veteran who has a winning record or a very appealing record either way. To beat him up as well, because like you said, I'm one of the best in the world and still am.
And just one fight deals, right? You take it, you know, you're not gonna I like that. You're not going to be controlled by anybody.
Yeah, no. Again, it's a very component in regard. It's a very interesting component. Again, eye opening in the capacity of being able to like own that. And again, whatever organization that I potentially do work with down the line, I will be able, because I have the rights to that, show everyone what I've been doing with both inside the cage and out.
Excellent. Is there anything you want to promote, push out there to all the fans out there listening or watching this podcast?
Appreciate both your time, and then also everyone else just watching this and kind of following my journey. You can find me at Elias Theodoro, and if you want to vape like a professional, you got Stores and Bickle to thank, available at Planet of the Vapes.
How come we didn't hit that during the show? I just remembered that.
Well, because we hit it beforehand or afterhand.
Okay.
But I'm always hitting it. I'm ready to go.
It's ready to go. Here we go. Elias, appreciate your time. This is episode 76. Helen, anything you want to add?
I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. I learned a lot today, actually, from that, because David's more of the weed, you know, marijuana.
Connoisseur,
and I'm still kind of learning, you know, so.
It's funny because this is our first time meeting, and I'm not the schmo character, yeah. But which is completely opposite, but I created that character just one night, just, you know, stoned and creative thinking. And that's what I love about it too. It's, which we didn't get into as well, is just talking about mushrooms and things like that. I'm such this type control A personality that this kind of stuff just allows my brain to think in a different way and be kind of beta for a few hours or whatever, and just write and have a creative mindset, which is important.
Yep. Everybody and everybody's different. And what's it called? Cannabis for myself and yours as well seems to be a positive influence.
I wish mine was like that. Yeah. I'll just trip out and cry.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need a good cry
and
session.
Sometimes, yeah.
So get it out.
The hunger thing is that's something that comes with the territory too, but you got to control that. You got to do your best. Episode 76 of the Schmo Zone podcast. We are out.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.